the book of Obadiah, if you can find it. It's only one page, maybe two, in your Bible, the book of Obadiah. Book of Obadiah, we're going to go ahead and read the entire book, and then we'll pray. We'll look at this small book, but important book this morning. Book of Obadiah begins, verse 1, the vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. Rise up, let us rise against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you've been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. All your allies have driven you to your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They have prevailed against you. Those who eat your bread have set a trap beneath you. You have no understanding. Will I not, on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men out of Edom, and understanding out of Mount Esau? And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter. Verse 10. Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. But do not gloat over the day of your brother in the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. Do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of distress. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head. For as you have drunk on my holy mountain, so all the nations shall drink continually. They shall drink and swallow and shall be as though they have never been. But in Mount Zion there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy. And the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble. They shall burn them and consume them, and there shall be no survivor for the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. Those of the Negev shall possess Mount Esau. Those of the Shephelah shall possess the land of the Philistines. They shall possess the land of Ephraim and the land of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead. The exiles of this host of the people of Israel shall possess the land of the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the Negev. Saviors shall go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Life is filled with paradoxes. Paradox is one of those statements that logically doesn't seem to connect. It doesn't seem to fit. If you stare at this triad, this triangle up there for very long, you'll see, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't work. It looks like it does, but it doesn't. But it does. That's what a paradox is. There are many paradoxes in life. One of the paradoxes is that it takes money to make money. Well, how can you make money if you don't have money? It takes money to make money. Another paradox is that your enemy's friend is your enemy. Or your youth is wasted on the young. You ever heard that one? Youth is wasted on the young. That's a paradox. We even have a name that we built into our education system that has a paradox built into it. The word sophomore is the idea of a wise moron. A paradox, is it not? Okay. ordinary life is just filled with paradoxes, but the Christian life is even more filled with paradox. Those statements of faith that you take by faith, but logically it doesn't make sense. The first shall be last. That makes no sense, and yet that paradox holds true. The meek shall inherit the earth. It is more blessed to give than to... And you can try to convince your kids of that one, but they just don't get it until a certain age. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will what? Lift you up. Whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel, Jesus said, shall find it. You lose your life in order to find it. One of life's greatest paradoxes comes with regard to the fear of the Lord. A common definition of the biblical theme of the fear of the Lord is reverent awe. And that's a good definition as far as it goes. Another good definition that I appreciate, one that's very practical, is a wholesome dread of displeasing God. The fear of the Lord, a wholesome dread of displeasing God. And as we looked in our study this summer in the book of Proverbs, we saw that our greatest fear is that which most powerfully defines our welfare and then moves us to pursue it. Therefore, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, because the fear of the Lord defines our greatest fear, which helps bring into relief what is it that most defines our welfare. We fear God. And then in that fear of God, we're moved to pursue our welfare and find it in Him. As we go through the minor prophets, the grand invitation is to enter into the ways of your God. When we come to the book of Obadiah, we see God sending one of His prophets to His people. Remember, these prophets function within the body of God's people. We don't know exactly where Obadiah found himself, whether he was still back in the land like Jeremiah was after the destruction of Jerusalem, or if he'd been carried off with some of the captives to Babylon or some place in between. But as Obadiah brings the message of God to the people of God, God deals with the shame of His people by confronting another people, a people who have no hope. And so God, in His mercy, gives hope to His people by confronting a people who have no hope. They have no hope because they have no fear of God. And so it's kind of a backwards message when you come to this book of Obadiah. God is giving this message to instill hope in His people. But this hope comes as He confronts a people who, because of their lack of fear of God, have no hope whatsoever. We need to understand, as we look at this very first line in the book of Obadiah, this is the vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. And we're like, yeah, that place. We've seen it on a map. We kind of know about it. We remember something about Edom. But what it is we're supposed to remember, just can't quite remember. Let's refresh our memory just a little bit about Edom. Its geographical location. We said it's right here, right down in the southeast corner, just below the province of Israel, the land of Israel. And so we know that this upper half was the split, the divided kingdom of Israel. This bottom half is the kingdom of Judah. And then right down to its southeast is Edom, right south, dead south of the Dead Sea, is where we find the land of Edom. Historically, we need to understand several things about this specific location, this specific people. First, we need to understand that this nation was apparently renowned within Israel for its great wisdom. We find that both in Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 7, and in Obadiah chapter 1, verse 8. God says, I will destroy the wise men out of Edom. The wisdom story of Job is probably located within this vicinity in this land called Uz, was its ancient name. Job 1:1 And Lamentations 4, verse 21, both refer to this location as Uz. Secondly, Edom, the word itself, means red, and it became the home of Esau. Keep your fingers here in Obadiah, because it's going to be hard to find if you don't. And turn back to Genesis, if you would. Genesis chapter 25. The word Edom means red, and in Genesis 25, we see that Esau has a red foreshadow in the very beginning of his story. Chapter 25, book of Genesis, verse 25. Verse 24, when her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb, and the first one came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak. So they called his name Esau. I'll jump down just a little bit to verse 30. One day Esau comes in from the field, he's exhausted, and Esau said to Jacob, let me have some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted. Therefore, his name is called Red. Okay. At the beginning of his story, he comes out red. He wants to eat red, and he's called Red. So there's kind of a little bit of foreshadow for the red man, Esau. Chapter 27, Genesis 27. We see that Esau receives a blessing, but it's a backhanded blessing of sorts. Remember that Jacob stole his blessing. And then Genesis chapter 27, verse 37, Isaac answered and said to Esau, behold, I have made him lord over you, and all his brothers I have given to him for servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son? And Esau said to his father, have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, away from the dew of heaven on high. And he talks about how he'll have to make his own way with his sword. Go up to chapter 36 of the book of Genesis. Genesis 36, verse 6. As this story of Esau comes to fullness, we see in Genesis chapter 36, verse 6, a story that sounds a lot like Abraham and Lot earlier in the story back in Genesis 14. But in Genesis 36, verse 6, we find the Bible says, then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, his livestock, all his beasts, all his property that he'd acquired in the land of Canaan, and he went into a land away from his brother Jacob, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojourning could not support them because of their livestock, so Esau settled in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. Esau is Edom. And as his story begins, there's a foreshadowing that he's the red man, and we see this story playing out that he has a blessing, but it's a backhanded blessing. It's not going to be the fullness of the earth. It's going to be a place where there is no dew. It's going to be a place where there's nothing. That's his inheritance, a place where there's nothing. And by his own choice, he decisively separates from his brother and goes and dwells away from the people of God, away from the chosen of God, to dwell by himself in Edom. Edom means red and became the home of Esau. And though the Edomites were Israel's relatives, they became Israel's enemies. In Numbers chapter 20, we see that the king of Edom resisted Israel on their way to Canaan. We see in Deuteronomy chapter 2 that God ordered Israel not to contend with Edom because it was God who gave them the place where they dwell. Esau chooses to go to a different place from Jacob, and he becomes great in that region. He becomes great by assimilating with the people of Edom, and he becomes kind of a first among equals and becomes kind of the king of the Edomites over time. And he basically overtakes the Edomites with power, with wisdom, because of God's blessing. And God said, Israel, don't you take anything from the Edomites. They're your brothers, and I've given them all that they have. Again, in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 7, God forbids Israel to despise the Edomites because they're Israel's brothers. He says, they've not treated you like brothers, but it's incumbent upon you to treat them like brothers. So don't despise them. Don't go in and annihilate them like you're annihilating others. I want you to preserve them, and their dignity in particular, because they're your brothers. Number four, as Israel's enemies, they were defeated by Israel's kings. So they would make their way and plunder and pillage Israel. And God did give the Israelite kings victory over Edom. King Saul defeats the Edomites in the late 11th century in 1 Samuel chapter 14. And then 40 years later in 2 Samuel chapter 8, King David and his general Joab defeat the Edomites at the Valley of Salt. And then they put up garrisons in their land and they make them vassals of Israel. Israel then possesses Edom, not as its own possession, but as a vassal state. And they have access then, when King Solomon takes the throne, to the Gulf of Aqaba. And then they go and they send out ships from that port. And much trade is done through the land of Edom on behalf of Israel. Number five, we need to keep in mind that God used Edom to instruct his people. God wanted his people to understand that his blessing extends to a people who are non-elect. Jacob is the elect, Esau is the non-elect, and God says, listen, my blessing falls on them just like it falls on you. And guess what? Your responsibility is to them because your responsibility is to me. So my blessing and your responsibility includes the people that I have not chosen as my own. An Edomite prince named Hadad escaped David's conquest and fled to Egypt and becomes a means of discipline that God uses for King Solomon when Solomon turns away from the Lord. So God isn't done with Edom, even though he's not chosen Edom to be blessed as Israel was blessed. Number six, we need to keep in mind as we historically put into place this people, we need to understand that God ultimately condemns them as a people because they despised God's people. That's a big deal, and that's where we find ourselves in the book of Obadiah. God condemns them as a people because they despised God's people. You can write down a couple references if you want to chase this down at all. Psalm chapter 137, verse 7. Psalm 137, verse 7. Amos 1, 6 through 11. And Ezekiel 36, verse 5. All these references help us to understand that the people of Edom, when Babylon comes in to destroy Judah, the people of Edom rejoice. They get excited. They capture the people that are trying to flee. They turn them over to the sword. They take them as captives to sell them as slaves. And they join in the looting of the entire nation. They go in and take possession of the land of God's people. The most prominent of the Edomites historically, what happened was Babylon comes in and destroys them. And then they kind of moved up into the regions of Israel, into the Negev section. And then others came and kind of intermarried with the Edomites, and they kind of lost their national identity to some degree. But they became called the Edomians. And we find the two of the most prominent Edomians in Scripture were the two Herods that directly oppressed God's son. Edom continually rejects God's people, and it's Herod the Great who murderously rejects Jesus, and then his son Herod Antipas who mocks Jesus and clothes him with a robe and sends him back to Pilate. But God says in Ezekiel 35 that because they cherished a perpetual enmity against my people, that God would make them a perpetual desolation. Because they had no love for the people of God, God cuts off his love for them. The last extra-biblical reference we have to Edom is on a Syrian inscription, when we have it that the Babylonians went in and campaigned against them. The last biblical reference that we have to Edom comes in Malachi chapter 1, verses 2 through 5, where God proclaims that they as a nation are permanently rejected and permanently destroyed. That makes them different from Israel. We understand that, right? Okay. Israel gets destroyed by Assyria. Israel gets destroyed by Babylon. But God's promise to Israel is always this: I tear you down, I will build you up. Go to Malachi chapter 1 real quick. Again, keep your fingers in the book of Obadiah. But Malachi chapter 1. God tells Israel, I will build you up. I will tear you down, I will build you up. But Malachi chapter 1, let's see, verse 4. If Edom says, we're shattered, but we'll rebuild the ruins, the Lord of hosts says, they may build, but I will tear down. They will be called the wicked country, the people with whom the Lord is angry forever. Your own eyes shall see this, and you shall say, great is the Lord beyond the borders of Israel. God will tear them down, destroy them forever, God says. So this is a people that in Isaiah chapter 34, verse 5, they're labeled the people that God has devoted to destruction. That devoted to destruction is kind of a technical phrase that means he's banned. It's the ban. They're devoted to fire. They're an offering to the Lord. It's like a sacrifice to God. I own them, and they will not be a blessing. They will be consumed. These are the people that are condemned by the Lord to be consumed by his wrath. In the New Testament, Esau then, or Edom, remains the opposite of God's people. God's people receive mercy. Edom receives judgment. God's people walk by faith. Edom walks by sight. God's people love what's holy. Edom rejects holiness and defiles the holiness of God. As we look at this book, again, we just need to get in our minds where it's situated and what it all means. Kingdom of Edom, right down here in the yellow, one of the main cities that came even after the destruction of Edom, probably during the time of Alexander the Great, because it shows much Hellenistic culture in the architecture that's carved in there. But Petra is one of the key cities within Edom. Right down here in the south, you've probably heard of Petra. It's called the Rose Red City. It's an extremely rugged area. Nothing grows worth mentioning. This is the area that Jacob's brother inherits, that Isaac says, okay, this is the place that you get to land in. Right here, this is called the pass. They're the shaft. It's only 13 feet wide. And this is where the armies would have to come in order to defeat the Edomites, and they did. You can see it's just walls of stone on either side, and that's the only way in. Thousands and thousands and thousands of lives poured in there and lost their lives there at the shaft. This is called the Rose Red City because all the rock in which it's carved is red. Edom means red. Everything in the city is carved into the rock. Whether it's the theater, the amphitheater, or their temple, or their homes, the monastery, everything is carved right into that red rock. Their tombs, everything's carved into rock. There's a beautiful, beautiful place within the city. It's called the Treasury. It's called the Jewel of Petra, and it's Al-Khazneh, or the Treasury. And it's just a beautiful, magnificent. If you can see these people sitting down here at the bottom, this is huge. It doesn't look that big, but this is huge. Any building in Washington, D.C. is about the size of that. Okay, so get this monumental, huge, vast array in front of you. That's what they built for themselves in this place. When we come to the book of Obadiah, we need to understand that a people without fear is a people without hope. Why do these people bear God's judgment? Why do these people bear God's wrath? Because they had no fear of God. And because there was no fear of God, there's no hope in God for them. So as we look at this passage, we have four reasons that we must fear the Lord. We're going to move through this rather rapidly. But I hope this message is not lost on you as we run through the book of Obadiah, only 21 verses. But we find four reasons that we must fear the Lord, lest we too end up like Edom. The first reason is this: we must fear the Lord because the Lord brings low those who are lifted up with pride. In verses 1 through 4, we see God speaking. There's the introduction of the prophet in verse 1, Obadiah, who means the servant of the Lord. He receives a vision, which is a technical term for a word of revelation from God. What's coming is coming from the mouth of God. It's not coming from a mind of the prophet. The introduction of the message is, "Thus says the Lord God." And you'll see here that the word God is all capitalized, meaning that that's the technical name for God, Yahweh. Yahweh who is Adonai, the Yahweh who is the master. It's a title that ascribes to him sovereignty, the one who's in charge. Yahweh who's in charge, Yahweh who is king is the idea. It describes his sovereignty. It also ascribes his reality. This is a living God. Concerning Edom, Edom we said is the word that means red, but it also is spelled the exact same as the word for man, Adam, Edom, Adam. Same letters, just different vowels that are stuck in there. And as we look at Edom and the destruction of Edom, we see this wordplay transferring. God's purpose for Edom is God's purpose for mankind. Edom, you've rejected God, therefore you will be destroyed. Mankind, if you reject God like Edom has rejected God, you too will be destroyed. And so we see there's a shift down on verse 15. The day of the Lord is near upon not just Edom, but upon all nations, all mankind. So there's this broadening that's prophetic within this prophetic book. The introduction of the means of this judgment says in verse 1, a messenger is sent among the nations with a report from the Lord. The report is this: rise up for battle against Edom. So God had punished his people Israel because of their sins. God says, I will now punish Edom because of their sins. Verse 2, Edom, God says, I will raise up armies against you, but it's I who will make you small. Verse 4, I will bring you down. And though the judgment is carried out by man, the initiative and the efficiency belong to God. It's an affront to God, and the answer comes from God. The introduction of the condition is pride. Verse 3, the pride of your heart has deceived you. When you stop and think about pride and the development that he gives in these next couple of verses, we see that pride starts rather innocently. There's a focus on survival. Esau goes to this place where there's no blessing, this place where there's no water, this place where there's no life, and he has to carve out of the rock, literally, a means of living, a way to survive. And so he does that. In survival mode, he carves out a living for himself, and his focus on survival builds for him a sense of security. He carves his life into the very rock, the red rock of these valleys of Mount Seir, this region. And as we focus on survival, we think ourselves secure. Look at verse 3. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock. You who've carved your living into the rock itself. Why? So that you're secure. You've built a security for yourself. But as we build our security, we move from survival mode to success mode. Look how he continues. You who live in the clefts of the rock in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you soar aloft like the eagle and your nest is set among the stars. You look at these pictures of how Edom prospered, of the ingenuity and all that they built for themselves. There is some measure of success. This was an amazing culture that they carved for themselves in the middle of the wilderness, in the middle of the desert. They made a life for themselves, and it was a good life. There was success. And in their success, they think themselves great. They dwell aloft. They soar aloft. They're living the good life. You ever ask somebody, how are you doing? Living the good life. Okay, that's where they're at. Living the dream. That's Edom. But as we shift from survival mode to success mode, we subtly slip into a sovereignty mode. They thought themselves secure. They thought themselves great. And when they thought themselves great, they thought themselves gods. Look at the end of verse 3. You say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Who can do it? I've built this city. I've built this life. I've made my way. I did it my way. Who can take me down? It's interesting that the Edomites, Stuart Briscoe writes, that scholars say that for the Edomites, they find no record or statement of any kind of any dependence whatsoever. The Edomites had no allegiance to any god. This has led many scholars to believe that this unusual people were so self-sufficient, arrogant, and self-satisfied, they wouldn't even call upon the name of any god. They were the first true secularists in history. No gods. We did it our way. We can do this. Is that amazing or what? Who's going to bring us down? God says, I will. I will. We must fear God because he brings those who are lifted up with pride. But we must fear God, number two, because he disappoints those who rely on human resources. In verse 5, he says to Edom, if thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, wouldn't they steal just enough for themselves? If grape gatherers come to you, wouldn't they leave some gleanings? When God deals with people who reject God, he deals with them and his judgment is profoundly thorough. All of our works will be exposed. He uses a metaphor of grape gatherers, and the idea is that God will glean all the fruits of your labors. It's written in the New Testament that every one of us must stand before the judgment seat of Christ. All of us must give account to God. Every word we say, every work we do, will be examined. God says, understand this. If there were grape gatherers, they gather grapes, and they miss some. They leave some, sometimes on purpose, sometimes just because it's not worth it. God doesn't deal with people that way. He looks at everything, everything, and all must be accounted for. God says, get ready, because I'm going to deal with you. And he says, oh, Edom, how you've been destroyed. The life that you built for yourself, it's ruined. It's brought down to destruction. He searches out all that we treasure. He examines all the works that we do, and he searches out everything that we treasure. He uses the second metaphor, actually first in the text here. But the second metaphor is that of thieves or plunderers, robbers who come by night. He says, listen, if a robber comes to your house, he's only going to take what he can bring with him on his back. He's only going to take the good stuff that will benefit himself or maybe a couple buddies. He can't take everything. He says there, how Esau has been pillaged and his treasures have been sought out. Interesting. Remember the name of this building carved into the rock? It's the Jewel of Petra. It's the treasury. Guess what's in there? Nothing. Nothing. Because everything that was stored there, that was secured there, has been found out. And as God deals with each one of us, he drills down and finds out, what is the treasure in your heart? And if it's not God, then it's an idol. Whether you bow down to it and acknowledge it as such or not. But this judgment is not only thorough, it's also painful. In verse 7, we see that our fear of man proves to be a snare. Verse 7, he says, all your allies have driven you to your border. You've been betrayed by those that you thought yourself allied with. Rather than defending your borders, they're driving you to your borders. Secondly, they're destroyed by those with whom they thought themselves at peace. Those at peace with you have deceived you. There's no truth in their peace. There's no benefit in their power. They've deceived you and prevailed against you or overpowered you. You thought that you had them on your side. You thought that you had their strength as your strength. Their strength turned against you and you've become their fodder. You've become powder. You've been ground by their wheels. Number three, you've been ambushed by those with whom you thought that you shared fellowship. The ones that eat your bread, they've ambushed you. They've set a trap and you didn't even know it. You didn't understand it. We have to understand that in the Old Testament, in these times in particular, to share a meal was to share fellowship. It was not just a meal, but it was a pledge of loyalty. But this was a treacherous pledge. They've trusted in their allies. They've trusted in other nations. And then verse 8, they've trusted in their wisdom. And verse 9, they've trusted in their strength. And our trust in man will prove unfounded. God says, I will destroy your wisdom. I will destroy your might. I will make your mighty men like screaming women, he uses in another passage. The idea is they're to be broken, to be shattered, to be distraught. It's the idea of what happened when Israel saw Goliath out on the field and they all shook in their boots and they lost all their manliness and they ran away. We need to fear God because if we don't, we'll get proud. And when we get proud, God brings us down. We need to fear God because if we don't rely on Him, we'll rely on something else. And the only resources that we have available are our own. And our own resources God will use to disappoint us. Number three, we must fear the Lord because He reduces those who increase by others' suffering. Specifically, the fall of Jerusalem. 587, 586 BC, Jerusalem falls. Edom's on the sidelines. They're watching it as though it were a football game. Come on. Work against Israel. Score another one. And as Israelites start running out from Jerusalem, they start running out from Judea, it's the Edomites who are standing at the crossroads and say, hey, wait, where are you going? No, no, no. They turn them over to the sword of the oppressors. Or they take them in and they sell them to another nation. And then they go in and loot the city. But as we watch them, what Edomites do to Israel, we see that there's a passivity. They're passive in their hostility. It says there in, let's go to verse 10. Because of the violence done to your brother, passively by somebody else, shame will cover you. Because, verse 11, on that day you stood aloof. It's your brother for crying out loud. The one that you have a responsibility to. The one that I told they have a responsibility toward you. And what did you do when their day of trouble came? You did nothing. Nothing. You did nothing. You stood there and watched. When violence was done to your brothers, when strangers carried off his wealth, when foreigners entered into his gates, when foreigners cast their lots for Jerusalem, he says, in fact, your doing nothing was actually doing something. You were like one of them. Your inactivity in your brother's need was actively destructive to your brother. And then he focuses on their hostility. Verses 12 down through verse 14. They're actively responsible. In their attitudes, they gloat at his misfortune. They rejoice in his ruin. They boast in his distress. That's in their attitudes. But in their actions, they themselves enter into his gates. They themselves loot his wealth. They themselves cut off his fugitives. They themselves hand over his survivors. God says, because of this, because of your active responsibility and your inactivity, which makes you responsible, I will hold you responsible. You bear the guilt. He says, shame shall cover you. Verse 10. And he says, finally, you will be cut off forever. Shame. It's the opposite of glory. It's likened to mud in the streets, to be trampled on like the mire. to be cut off means to be felled, to be excluded, to be exterminated. As a result of their persecuting God's people, they will be cut off from God's people. We need to fear God because he reduces those who increase at others' expense. Oh, sure glad we don't do that, right? Sure glad we don't rejoice when others fall. Sure glad we don't take advantage when somebody has a tough time of it. The last reason we need to fear the Lord is the only positive reason that's given in the entire book, and that's this. Because God prepares a glorious future for those who trust in him. And in verse 15, it doesn't seem like the tone really changes. He gives a universal principle. The day of the Lord is near. It's near upon all nations. Edom, not just you, but upon all nations. And he's not necessarily talking time. He's talking realms. There's this visible realm that we can see, but at the same time operating at the exact same time, but in a different sphere, is this day of the Lord. And at any moment, God can reach in from one sphere to the next because he created both. And he can operate like that. Nebuchadnezzar didn't think about it. But in the pride of his heart, he's walking on the parapets one day and he says, look at this great Babylon which I've built. And God says, today's the day. And he reaches in from one sphere into the other and says, okay, Nebuchadnezzar, this is your day. The day when I interact with you in real time, in real space. And for 7 years, he acts like an animal until he turns his eyes to heaven and God reaches in again from one sphere to the next and changes his heart to the heart of a man and restores his glory. This universal principle is that the day of the Lord is near. It's upon all nations, and God will put upon their own heads the deeds that they have done. Then he uses a specific illustration in verse 16. He says, as you, Edom, have drunk on my holy mountain, that is, in celebration of victory over God's holy people, as you've danced in lewdness on my holy place and defiled it, in that same way, all nations will drink, will carouse, will celebrate continually. But their end is this, they shall be as though they have never been. And the unstated message here is, Edom, just like you. They will be nothing just like you will be nothing. But there's a significant exception in verse 17. But in Mount Zion there shall be those who escape. There's going to be a holy people. It's going to be a united people. It's going to comprise the people of the house of Jacob. It's going to comprise the people of the house of Joseph. The southern kingdom, the northern kingdom, they're all going to be God's people. It's going to be a powerful people. They're likened to a flame. They're likened to a fire. They burn. They consume. They stand in contrast to Edom, who's likened to stubble, which is burned and is consumed. There's complete destruction. God says there's no survivors. And it's an emphatic destruction because I've spoken. And what I say will come to pass. It's a holy people. It's a holy place. He says, Mount Zion shall be holy. Verse 17, did you see that? In Mount Zion there shall be those that escape, and that mount will be holy. You've defiled it, but I will undefile it. You've made it as something common. I will make it as something special. You've defiled, but I can still make holy what you've ruined, Edom. This holy place, Mount Zion, accomplishes an old promise. He says, Jacob will take possession of this place. End of verse 17. The house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. It goes back to an old promise. My people will possess the land of my blessing. Then he says in verse 20, the exiles of the host of this people, the leftovers, the remnant of the people that you thought to destroy, the outcasts, the nothings, will come back and they're going to take over everything. They're going to take over Mount Esau. They're going to take over the land of the Philistines. They're going to take over the land of Ephraim, the land of Samaria, Gilead, Canaanites, Negev, north to south. The remnants, the nothings are going to come back, and they're going to own everything. This is a new conquest, if you will. And there's a restored kingdom. Verse 21, saviors, deliverers will go up to Mount Zion in order to rule Mount Esau. My holy place will be exalted. Your holy place will be decimated. It's going to be ruined. It's going to be ruled by those who were you thought were nothing. But now they've become everything. Your places are swapped. There's something that happens here. Rogland writes, the prophet mentions the leaders of this new conquest as deliverers or saviors who ascend Mount Zion to rule. The terminology of this verse, as well as the conquests in verses 19 and 20, intentionally evoke the book of Judges, where the Lord raises up saviors or judges to deliver his people from their enemies. Strikingly, in this vision of Obadiah, Israel's restoration, the ultimate resolution, is the appearance of judges under the kingship of Yahweh. It doesn't focus on a king. It focuses on these rulers that operate with God as king. And so there's this provision then, in the midst of this holy people, in the midst of this holy place, in Mount Zion there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy. Think forward historically. Mount Zion is there in Jerusalem. It's the place of Golgotha. It's where Jesus Christ died. It's the place where God's judgment became God's salvation. And God's salvation becomes God's blessing. As a result of God's judgment on Edom, over time they began to be absorbed into the Jewish nation. They lost their distinct ethnic identity. I want you to go to the book of Mark, chapter 3. Because this is the end of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. Mark chapter 3. There's a twist in God's paradox. Mark chapter 3, verse 7. And Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and where? Idumea. Edomites. And from beyond the Jordan and from around all Tyre and Sidon, when the great crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to Jesus. There's a holy place, and some who find it will escape. Esau, left to yourself, there'll be no survivors, but let me provide a way of escape. A place where my judgment becomes my salvation. A person without fear is a person without hope. Edom was that person. Edom was that people. But God's people are those whose fear and hope are one. We fear God. And in fearing God, we find our hope in God. Why? Because only in God does his judgment become my salvation. And that's what we celebrate this morning. God's judgment has become my salvation.